Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between what's going on with us and our well-being and what's going on with the well-being of our families, our communities, our regions, our country, with the food, water, air, earth, sky, and everything, you know, that makes up our interconnected world. We also talk about the health or lack of health in our policies, in our society, and in some of the larger trajectories of some of our individual and social choices have created for us that we now live with and within. So we talk, the show is now in its ninth year, and we always talk every week with different thought leaders, activists, farmers, filmmakers, authors, scientists, poets, organizers, all different kind journalists. We've had a lot of journalists on the show, people who have a different view of the interconnected aspects that affect our lives and our health. And that's what we talk about every week on the show. And this week we have a returning guest. I'm happy to say someone that we have an ongoing conversation with. And that is Dave Chapman. He's a farmer, and Longwind Farm is his farm in Vermont. He is also the executive director of the Real Organic Project. And Real Organic, which we have and covered on the show actually since before its inception, that goes back almost, I guess it's approaching 2 years or more now, is really facing, helping, bringing together all of the pioneering farmers and all the current farmers and helping the people who grow our food and the most healthful food, the organic food that so many of us, you know, thrive on and treasure and make such a sort of centrally important thing in our lives, you know, what's happening with it? How do we come to terms with how some of the larger grinding factors in our society are impacting the organic food that many of us have sought out for health, well-being, taste, and enjoyment for, you know, 25, 40 years and even earlier. And so the Real Organic Project is really helping speak of that and grapple with it. And, of course, we'll be talking about that on today's show in certain different kinds of ways. So I'm just delighted to welcome you back to Connect the Dots, Dave Chapman.
Thank you, Allison.
You know, we have been talking, attending conferences, you know, sharing articles about the kind of takeover in progress of the National Organic Program at the USDA, which has, you know, for 25 or so years been the stable center and guarantor for most of the public of organic food through its role in establishing and overseeing the certifying of the organic standards. So we've had many discussions about that. I certainly, as a journalist, am deeply aware of it. And yet I kind of had a sort of horrible epiphany about a week or 10 days ago. I have belonged to my same food co-op, which is within walking distance of my city apartment in Brooklyn, New York, for over 20 years. And it's one of the original, oldest, and largest food co-ops in the United States. It's a worker-run co-op. And I also have been a reporter on and an editor of the in-house newspaper. And so because of the reporting and the conversations that I've had with Dave Chapman and Lisa Stocky, also of Real Organic, as well as we've had, you know, numerous people on the program recently over the last several years talking about health and agriculture, I'm very aware of, you know, the battle that played out at the 217 National Organic Standards Board over the inclusion of hydroponic berries under the designation of organic. And this was a move that, you know, people opposed, farmers opposed, everyone opposed. At the co-op, I was, you know, spring is here, the berries are out, and I was looking at the rows of berries, and even though I've been aware of this for, you know, several years reporting on it, I was shocked to see that the only option for purchasing berries was Driscoll berries, Driscoll being the brand that has really turned berries into a monocrop culture and is taking over berry production in a massive and international way. And yet I was still sort of shocked and surprised to see that there were no other options at my food co-op, which buys regionally and does all these different things. And I got on the paging system to talk to the people stocking produce in the basement, and I said, are there any non-hydroponic berries available for sale? And a young woman came on the paging system, and she said, oh, my. She said, all our berries are non-hydroponic. Hydroponic berries are not organic.
Right.
And I was like, no one knows. People don't know.
No one knows. Yeah. Yeah. So this has been a very velvet revolution, a very quiet takeover. As with the CAFO livestock production, these are the two great failures of the USDA to protect the organic label. And in both cases, there's just been this astonishing growth rate of a very conventional agriculture type production system that has managed to, I think illegally, but nonetheless has managed to take on the USDA label certified as organic. And it's a complicated conversation, but one of the things that is a real outcome of this takeover is that the real organic producers are pushed off of the shelves and out of the food system. And this has been quite recent in the last 4 years, probably, for vegetables. For milk, it's been going on longer, and for eggs, perhaps longer still. So, in most stores in America right now, it is very hard to get. It's certainly hard to get an organic, certified organic berry that you know was grown in the ground. And it's very hard to get an organic certified tomato that you know came from a plant grown in the ground. It's also very hard to get organic eggs that come from chickens that run around outside. So most people are very unaware of this, including the people who work in the stores and sell it. And many of those people, when they find out, are quite upset by it. But as with climate change, it's easy to fall into a state of overwhelm and defeat where it seems so out of our control. And I think that the Real Organic Project is an attempt to try and reclaim some of our ability to act and some of our ability to build a community where the farmers and the eaters who care about these things, and not everybody does, but those who do, can find each other. So I'm not surprised by the story of the person working, you know, in the co-op not understanding what she was selling. I've seen it over and over again. And people insisting, no, this can't be hydroponic. It's certified organic.
You know, she was a young person, and I don't know that I could, not being that young a person, could imitate her voice that well. But, you know, she had a young, idealistic voice, and it made me, she was, you know, so confident and idealistic, you know, that came across in her voice. And I was just kind of horrified that it happened so quickly and that there weren't, you know, other little boxes and green, you know, paper boxes of other berries that had kind of trundled in, from local farms, as I would normally expect that there to be. And also, I have to just parenthetically add, which is a whole separate part of the conversation, since I oversee the editing of the newspaper, we had a report this week that from the meat buyer that the chicken supplier is changing to Smart Chicken. And
oh,
I looked up. Yes, I know. I didn't know, but I looked it up, and the buyer, who's been very good and works very hard, explained, you know, the logistical reasons why this had to be. But you know, they have an organic name on the label, but this is not the same chicken. It's owned by Tyson's, which is one of the largest and most environmentally destructive, monocrop food warehouses and suppliers, and here it is, you know, the chicken and the chicken section.
And this is the challenge that we all face in the food system. And what is happening is that companies are combining, and so, you know, one company will own a number of chains. They become very vertically integrated. They're looking for suppliers for their house brands, which are replacing farms. And, of course, they're going to look to a company like Tyson's or a company like Driscoll's, who can supply them year-round with essentially the same product every day of the year. And it's very convenient for the store to do the business with one supplier. The problem, so many problems, but one big problem with this is that ultimately competition is actually driven out of the marketplace, and it becomes a sort of de facto monopoly. And the result of that is that somebody like me or you, who goes into a store and wants to buy a particular kind of food, which we would call real organic, that food is, you know, for a while it's been a little bit difficult to identify it, but it's getting to the point now where it's literally just not available. Now, there is still lots of real organic food available under the organic label, so we shouldn't, you know, walk out of this conversation saying, I'm not going to bother to buy organic. I always buy organic. And a great deal of that food really is organic, and some of it really isn't. In the case of organic eggs, probably the number I've seen is probably about 80% is coming from CAFO, meaning concentrated animal feeding operation type producers, kind of a smart chicken, but they have smart chicken for eggs too. And, these are large industrial egg operations, fully enclosed. Chickens never go outside, and on the egg carton, I'll have a nice picture of a happy chicken out in the grass, but that does not reflect the reality at all. And so in that way, it's very fraudulent marketing. And the same thing is true on many milk cartons, where they're coming from, again, large concentrated animal feeding operations, the milk, and the picture on the milk carton is of a cow out eating grass, but for probably half of the organic milk in America, they're not. they're in a feedlot. Now, we have to not just burn the house down. We have to understand that there are plenty of real organic farmers out there selling to a company like Organic Valley. And the question is, how do we get the food that we want to buy? And how do we not let the farmers that we want to buy from get driven out of business? When you talk about blueberries, we had a symposium up at Dartmouth College this winter, the Real Organic Project Symposium. And, you know, one of the speakers talked about the challenges of selling soil-grown organic blueberries. And, you know, this farmer is really struggling to find a market for his absolutely delicious berries. I've eaten them. And they're the blueberry that you and I and millions of people in America are hunting for. They're delicious. They're nutritious. They're beautiful. They have great texture. They were grown in the soil. And places like that are literally being put out of business by very large-scale hydroponic operations where they cover the ground in plastic. In some cases, they actually spray the ground with herbicide before they cover it in plastic. And they're getting certified the next week, and they're selling the berries a year later. And, you know, essentially it's a conventional hydroponic berry. Hydroponic, just to say, what, you know, not everybody knows what that means. Hydroponics is a kind of growing in which the plant gets all or most of its nutrition from a liquid feed that is, you know, put on as irrigation. And meaning it's not getting its nutrition from a complex soil ecology. It's not getting its nutrition in the way that plants have evolved for 300 million years in this relationship with the fungi and the bacteria and the, you know, many insects, mammals that are living in the soil. There's this amazing complex dance. And the fact that the alternative, hydroponic, is not complex, it's relatively simple, and that's what makes it attractive for producers. It's a relatively simple system, and you get some processed fertilizers. In the case of things that are being certified as organic, those fertilizers are allowed in organic production by the, you know, National Organic Program. But when those were allowed for organic production, they were intended as supplements that you would add a small amount at critical times. They were never intended to replace soil fertility. And in these cases, they've completely replaced it. There is, in fact, no soil in the system. So it's a very different way of feeding a plant. As it turns out, much like a CAFO, it's very productive in terms of pounds per acre. But as Vandana Shiva said, it's very unproductive in terms of health per acre. It's a different thing. You can't say that we're growing tomatoes cheaper than that person over there when they're really a totally different product. And I think that there's no way, you know, that what makes these places efficient is that I believe they sacrifice a certain nutritional quality of the food, and they usually also sacrifice a certain quality of life for the workers. So they're working with very low paid help, people working in the fields or working in the greenhouses, and they squeeze the pay scale down, and the nutritional density of the food is less, but the yield, the volume, is high. And the input cost is relatively low because it's a simple system. One of the problems of a simple system is that it doesn't have the amazing checks and balances in a complex system. So when you get a simple system without all that different rich microbiology living in it, it's very easy for one bad actor to become a problem in the soil. So they're very prone to disease. They're very prone to insects. And of course, the solutions to these are fungicides and insecticides. So the whole system is more vulnerable. That's why in a real organic system, the lack of insecticides is meant to be a result of how you farm rather than what makes you organic. It's the result of a basis of farming based on raising the livestock in the soil, which will create, we hope, a good balanced system in which insects and diseases are not a problem.
It's the whole basic idea. It's the whole Pasteurian idea of, you know, which is more important, the germ or the terrain. And, you know, our whole medical system has basically ignored the terrain until it kind of came bouncing back through the microbiome. But basically in just,
right.
you know, let's kill this germ, bang, let's get rid of that, use an antibiotic, and, you know, we just focus on germs. We don't focus on the total health of the terrain. In medicine and healthcare, that the terrain is the body, you know. In
yeah.
food, it's the soil, it's the earth, you know. And supposedly on his deathbed, Louis Pasteur, the great microbiologist who had been in a long intellectual philosophic debate with his rival, Antoine Béchamp over in France, you know, where Pasteur, on whom we, you know, kind of base a lot of our philosophy of medicine, was fighting for the germ as being of ultimate importance, and Béchamp was maintaining that the terrain was of ultimate importance.
Yeah.
And on his deathbed, Pasteur famously reneged and said Béchamp was right. And, you know, going through whatever his health devolution
was. There was a similar epiphany. There was a similar epiphany with Justus von Liebig, who was the father of chemical agriculture. And he really kind of invented the idea that you could boost production by supplying the right amount of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And towards the end of his life, he recanted and said, no, we need to really pay attention to the organic matter and the life in the soil as well. And that part of his message got a little bit lost, and the first part of his message became the foundation of chemical farming, which we now call conventional farming. So
it's interesting to
see. Yeah, these people who are really, they're really brilliant people, and they really learned something that's important. It's not that their initial discoveries weren't significant. It's just that they came to understand that they were seeing these things as simple systems when they aren't. They're complex systems. And if we ignore that, it's at our peril. When we talk about food being cheap, and America's got the cheapest food in the history of humanity, you know, in terms of the percentage of your income that is spent on food, it's a smaller percentage now than it's ever been. And America is, I think, 10 or 15% lower than Europe. So we really have cheap food in America. But, and you know, there are a lot of political reasons for this because, you know, if there's one thing that the politicians have learned, it's that people do not like expensive food. But, you know, we have to realize that as our food has gotten cheaper, our healthcare costs have gone up dramatically. And I think that that's not... I think the connection is very significant there. So when we look at how we grow our food, and if we say, well, it's cheaper to grow something hydroponically, yes, but if you factor in unintended consequences like healthcare, like impact on environment, then in fact that food might be far more expensive than the food that's grown in a real organic way.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure, you know, viscerally that might be true, because before I became, you know, a reporter and editor, I was a checkout person. And, you know, this is a large co-op. It has 17,000 people. And as a health and nutrition reporter, I was, you know, in my regular work, but, you know, they're checking people out with their food. I would look at the people and the food they were buying to see, you know, how the people... And, you know, how the people match the food, like what was, you know, and so this is nothing, this is a subjective, you know, study, right? You know, so it would be considered non-existent, doesn't exist in terms of scientific measures. It's completely a subjective response. But there was definitely a visual correlation between the health and vibrancy of the people and the food they were buying, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, it just kind of, it's kind of a, you know, a no-brainer. I mean, the other thing, too, that I was thinking about concerning this was that you know, there was long a debate in natural health circles, you know, because some of the doctors, you know, holistic doctors recommend supplementing, you know, with supplements because the caliber of nutrients in the food and in the soil has become so depleted. That has become necessary. And, you know, there's always this, oh, you know, why do we have to have supplements? You're just ripping us off, you know, argument. And then we always show the USDA studies of the decline, you know, of nutrient value.
Yes.
And then right. It's like, so then people are taking supplements, but then there are always natural health doctors who take a stand and say, forget the supplements. You know, what's more most important is eating healthy food. And I, you know, I've worked on a number of books with prominent natural health doctors, and I can't think of a single one that wasn't recommending organic food, really. They all recommend it. You know, and so there we go. Like, and a lot of people, it makes more sense. Not everyone likes to be taking supplements, you know, can afford them or whatever, to, you know, complement the fact that we've denatured the food. But then you go from, well, I want to have the food instead of the supplement, to eating the food that takes the supplement, because that's what these berries are. They're these, like, wand creatures, you know, these hydroponic berries are these, like, wand, underfed creatures in these long laboratories of plastic being dosed like as if they're IV patients or something, you know, on these little
yeah.
watery mixes. And then they, you know, and it's such a, you know, terribly anemic and unkind
well,
thing to do to a plant. I'm sorry. But
yes, they're the CAFOs of the vegetable world. You know, you can make them big. As I say, the pounds per acre can definitely go way up, but
mm-hmm.
you know, people also get big on a diet of McDonald's, and that
mm-hmm.
does not make them healthy. It just makes them big. So we shouldn't, you know, confuse size with quality, of course. And usually our tongues are reasonable ways of measuring nutritional quality. And if,
mm-hmm.
if, although, of course, our tongues can get blunted by a diet that is, you know, heavily weighted to sugar or something. But if you can still taste, you can usually easily taste the difference between something that's good for you and something that isn't so great. So if you need to dose the food with salt or sugar, it's probably because something isn't right in the first place. We, you know, have this new strange phenomenon of a group of people who are both obese and malnourished simultaneously. And, this is a common event now in America. And I think that those two are also probably connected in ways that we barely understand, which is that I think if you're eating food that is nutritionally unbalanced, I think it creates cravings. And you're doing your best to satisfy those cravings, but as they say, you're looking for love in all the wrong places. And you,
mm-hmm.
you know, you end up with a bag of chips or cookies when what you really want is a tomato that was grown in the ground, in good, healthy ground. And this was always the principle of organic farming. It was always the belief that in order to be healthy, you needed to eat healthy food, and healthy food came always from healthy soil. And, you know, starting with Albert Howard, and of course, long before that, he wasn't the inventor. He was the, I would say, you know, he carried that banner. He discovered when he was sent to Asia as an agricultural agent that, you know, the people he was sent to advise seemed to know a lot more about a sane kind of agriculture than he did. And so he brought that back, developed it in India, and brought it back to England. And from his writings, the organic movement was born.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'd never heard that story before. Oh, that's fascinating. So that's so interesting because also because Vandana Shiva has played, has been such a voice, you know, for the local farmer, for the healthy food. I mean, you know, she's a huge voice. And, you know, it's, I didn't realize that actually some of this understanding was sourced in India. How fascinating is that? Wow.
Yeah, his books, Soil and Health and an Agricultural Testament, he tells that story of how he came to, you know, learn this stuff. And of course, he stayed in India for quite a while doing experiments with composting and cover cropping, and then brought that back, and it became a movement. There were others in Europe. You know, Rudolf Steiner was 20 years earlier, and King in America was even 15 years before that. And he went to Asia and traveled around and said, you know, his famous book was Farmers of 40 Centuries. And he was looking at land that had been continuously, intensively farmed for 4,000 years and was still productive and was still fertile. And what were the techniques by which they did that? And it was through really careful stewarding, protection of, encouraging organic matter in the soil. And I would say, you know, that much of that soil that King looked at in 1910 is probably no longer fertile, because those people, those cultures have adopted agriculture from the United States and chemical-based agriculture. So they have reversed. there probably won't be another century where that land is going to be healthy and producing healthy food.
You know, it's such an irony because replacing the kind of complex interconnection world of nutrients that exists in soil and plants with chemicals, you know, something man-made that's attempting to short-circuit these natural processes, but which in and of themselves, you know, go on, as we're now finding out, many have long suspected it and were kind of poo-pooed and laughed at and all, as we're finding out the dark side of GMO agriculture in recent court cases, where there's a direct correlation, apparently, to, now they're saying, even two uses of glyphosate can be, drastically increase incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, of course, there are thousands of people who've been using this and have developed that in a whole long army of lawsuits, which are coming out of that and which are being won by the plaintiffs, the parties injured by the deception around the use of these chemicals.
And, you know, glyphosate is a plague upon our house, but we also have to remember, and it's spectacular, that perhaps Monsanto will be, to some degree, brought to being responsible for what they have done. But we also need to remember that it's just part of a system. It's a part of a way of thinking about farming in which we substitute chemicals for wisdom, you know, and we make a very simple system that's replicable, much like the McDonald's model. And it's not that the people who invented those systems are stupid. They're not. They're very smart. And they figured out, look, we can make something that's simple and that can be done over and over, and it will work. And the people who run the systems make the money. So the people who run the local McDonald's franchise don't make so much, but the people who run the whole chain do very well. And you know, similarly, Monsanto, now Bayer, does very well. The poor farmers who are out there spraying the stuff, they don't do so well. You know, they're pretty desperate. They've got the highest suicide rate of any occupation in the country. But they feel trapped in it. They don't know how to get out of it. And, you know, I would say that one of the very tragic things that has gone on with the USDA failing to protect the organic brand is that that alternative, which was there not just for eaters, but also for farmers, is now disappearing. Not very long ago, it was possible for a farmer who said, I want to get off this chemical treadmill, and I'm going to go through the 3-year transition, and I'm going to get certified organic, and I'm going to farm differently. That was possible, and they could make a living. When they got to the other side of that, they could make a living. Now we see a thing, and that was, you know, very common, for example, in dairy farming. And now we see where, I think it was USDA Today, and then Cornucopia reprinted it, the story of the six large CAFOs in Texas producing 1.3 times the milk of 450 family organic farms certified in Wisconsin. And, you know, the difference is those six CAFOs, I think they average about $27 million per farm, as opposed to about $250,000 per farm for the family farms in Wisconsin as an average. So, you know, those farms in Wisconsin were viable. People were making a living. They were doing okay. And what happens when the large CAFO industrial farms come in is that they drop the price of milk. They create an oversupply. And the family farms cannot compete with it. And they're forced to go out of business. The CAFOs aren't necessarily making money, but they have deep pockets, and they cannot last that until the others are driven out. And so even though there's a glut in milk, they're actually expanding. The CAFOs continue to build. And we have something that's just so grim. I think last year I was told by a California dairy farmer that 20% of the dairy farms in California, organic dairy farms in California, went out of business. And, you know, these are hard times. And of course, it's, you go, well, that's tragic for the farmers. I'm sorry, that's capitalism. But it's not that simple, because the milk that they're producing is the milk that everybody wants to buy. But that's not the milk they're getting. So we have this Shakespearean tragedy starting to play out, where people who are producing something that we all want to eat are going out of business, and what's left is that nutrient-poor, factory-farmed food, you know, people working on those farms, sometimes in conditions close to slavery. I mean, the whole thing is just grim. And the goal of the Real Organic Project is to stand up and say, let us find each other. Let us create a label so that people who want to buy this can locate it in the store, so they can say to the produce people, we would like to see this label. And the produce people go, good, this we can trust really isn't hydroponic. This we can trust really was raised on pasture. And that is the purpose of the Real Organic Project, is to be educational, actually, and to have people delve a little bit deeper than just a brand. The problem with a brand is it can be stolen, and the organic brand is being stolen. I was just on a panel down in Washington, D.C. I got invited to speak, and it was to the North American Agricultural Journalists. And the topic was the schism in organic. And I got up, and I had talked with Elliot Coleman before I went. And Elliot said, Dave, you've got to tell him there is no schism. And I said, you're right, Elliot. So I said, you know, I want to say that there is no schism in organic. This is not a division. This is a hostile takeover. And the organic movement is pretty united. We pretty much all agree that organic needs to be grown in the soil, that the animals need to have access to real pasture, to real grass. And this division, this battle, is not a battle between organic advocates. This is a battle between the organic movement and invaders. And I think that one of the things that's very important is that the eaters, and we are all eaters, need to be involved in this, and need to take responsibility, because the real organic farmers can only survive if they're supported. Otherwise, we're all gone.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing that's really strange about it is that capitalizing on the label organic, you know, you have cookies and crackers and energy bars and, you know, all sorts of products.
Organic gummy bears.
Yeah, I mean, they're completely inessential. We could totally do without them. They don't represent, and yet, you know, you have companies that come up with the latest this or the latest that or you know, how to make a cup that you individually brew your, you know, one cup of, or two cups of coffee in every day, and you're using resources for that. You know, all kinds of gratuitous things that we are, you know, that we think we have a choice about, you know, where you have these ersatz things that you don't need, and then there are these few essential things standing there in full sight. It's almost like a presidential primary. You know, with like these constructed products that aren't delivering the nutrients we need, and then the few that are, you know, can you discern them amid, you know, all the apparent choice and plenty? I could do without a Clif Bar. I mean, I actually can never find, I mean, I'm the kind of person who reads every label, and I've read every energy bar label at the co-op. I've read them all, and I wouldn't eat any of them. You know, I understand that people on the go, you know, need something. I don't know why you can't just get, like, some nuts and dried fruits, but, you know, whatever. You know, a little nut butter or hemp milk or whatever. That is a packaged product that I use, the hemp milk. But, you know, we've kind of traded, and the convenience, you know, who needs year-round berries? I mean, do we really need year-round berries, or do we need, you know, those beautiful late spring into early summer berries, you know, when berries naturally grow and they're a treat, you know, like at the food co-op, you know, we get lychees at a certain time in June, you know, and we get organic bitter melon at a certain time in late summer. You know, I wait for those things, you know, and stock up when they're there and eat a lot of them, because the earth is also supplying us, you know, if we're in a seasonal world, which we are certainly in the Northeast, you know, according to the season. But the idea that we're just kind of nowhere in Nowhereville, eating anything we want at any time, and that the earth is there to serve us, you know, this because it's in, you know, a recipe or something that I had. It's so out of sync. And to me, that's also connected with our unconsciousness about the environment and the climate changes that are happening. You know, we are disconnected, and, you know, and then we become too important in the overall picture rather than play, you know, being in our rightful place, which is to
yes.
support this, you know, not take from it all the time.
One of the things that I've seen that is so confusing to me is to see, as we appear to get more and more choices, that we are often getting fewer and fewer choices. And, you know, an example of this is I was in, you know, an alternative type chain supermarket in Boston, and it was the height of strawberry season in Massachusetts, and the only organic strawberries were Driscoll's from God knows where. That was the only organic strawberry that they had, and they had a conventional field tomato, a small number of, and they were very low quality. And I thought, you know, this is just, you know, this is a kind of a broken system right now. And, you know, one of the things that I know that's happening is that in order to have those berries year-round, Driscoll's will say, but you've got to not carry an alternative during the outdoor season, because we want to sell our berries every day of the year. And it's a complicated situation for the store, for the wholesaler supplier, and there are only about two left in the country, and of course for the customer, who after a while starts to forget what real strawberries taste like, and starts to forget what real tomatoes taste like, unless they're going to a CSA, a farmer's market, or a farm stand. And of course you can get great food, seasonal food, all those things that we want, grown in the soil, animals on pasture, in those local outlets, and that is the best of all choices. But Even in Vermont, which is a relative food heaven, in January, virtually all the food is coming from out of state and from warm locations. And we still want to buy organic food then. And I'm happy to support those organic farmers in Florida or California or Mexico if they're doing a good job of growing really organic food. We need to eat. But, unfortunately, the system is now constructed that people growing real organic food in those places also can't get into the system. And the system is becoming more and more the industrial plantations. So somehow we need to create some alternatives. There are plenty of small producers doing a good job all over the world. As Vandana Shiva said, 70% of the world's food is grown by very small farmers, very small-scale farms. And she said, thank heavens, because if it was only 65%, the world would probably end, because that other 30% is enormously destructive to the environment. So, there are these choices, but we have a problem of distribution. We have a problem of market access. We have a problem where competition is actually squashed rather than encouraged. I know, like, for most of the farmers I know, they would be happy to compete. The dairy farmers would be happy to compete with the CAFOs if the products were honestly labeled. So if you want to grow CAFO milk, great. Have a picture of a CAFO on the cover, right? And if it's pasture raised, good. Have a picture of a cow on a pasture. Guess which one people are going to buy, right? If you want to have a picture of chickens in confinement on the egg carton and compared to one with a picture of the chicken out in the grass, guess which one people are going to buy if those pictures are honest. And, so our problem isn't that the small people, that the people doing real organic can't compete. The problem is there's massive fraud going on in the marketplace. And if we could have real integrity and transparency of labeling, then we could actually see the world change very quickly. People don't want to buy hydroponic, and the hydroponic producers know it. That's why they lie about it. If you write Driscoll's and ask them if they grow hydroponically, they will write back and say, no, we do not. Well, that
How
requires
can they say
enormous,
that?
Well, they changed the definition of the word hydroponic. It's kind of a Bill Clinton thing. How do you define sex? I mean, they're misleading people, and they're doing it quite intentionally and knowingly, but that is, I've had a number of people send me such a letter. So that is the answer they get. Wholesome Harvest, speaking to 10 million people on Morning Edition, their marketing manager said, we do not grow hydroponically. Well, good heavens, they're a pure hydroponic operation. And I know plenty of hydroponic producers who are not ashamed of that. That's the thing here. It's only when hydroponic comes into organic that it becomes a dirty word. I don't think hydroponic production grows the best quality food. I don't think it's the best for the planet. But I have good friends who are hydroponic producers. They're not evil people, and they believe in what they do. They're proud of it. But when you get into this thing where that food is being misrepresented to the people, well, that's fraud. And, I think people have a right to know what they're buying and then make their choice. And I think that if they do know, they're going to make better and better choices. And right now, the opposite is what's happening. Just like that young person in the produce section at Park Slope telling you, no, these are not hydroponic. Well, they are. She was misled.
Well, it's also on the store, I think, to be frankly disclosing. And not to just do this. I mean, even looking around at like salad greens and stuff like that, once you sort of develop an eye for it, you can kind of spot these bags of greens where, there are little water droplets clinging to the plastic. Or, I mean, I make, I really love basil and pesto and make all of that. And I got a hydroponically grown pesto. Never said that it was. It was just I later, when I was doing a story on it, came to realize that that brand is all hydroponic. And so I then went to taste it, and it was utterly tasteless. And, you know, I kind of went through a phase where I was, like, putting pesto in everything. I just, you know, love basil so much. But, you know, and it didn't taste like basil. It absolutely did not. But, you know, then you kind of get used to it. It's there. You don't know which one is which because of the confusion over labeling. So the deception travels all the way down the line. And, you know, one of our reporters was doing an article, I think, on what's, you know, the recent discovery that kale is now one of the Dirty Dozen. And she did some sort of shopper interviews on the floor. And then she was commenting on some things that people said. And she said, oh, we don't have to worry. Everything here is organic. You know, the co-op has us covered. And so, you know, that's the other thing, is that people don't like being in a system that's in transition where, you know, they'd rather just believe than investigate because it's disturbing, you know. But we're at that kind of delicate place where we have to encourage the investigation or, you know, the whole thing could be heading south, unfortunately. So.
Yeah. It's the enormous opportunity for the co-ops, frankly, because, you know, unfortunately, the USDA has failed in their mission, and they didn't want the mission. But when the Organic Food Production Act was passed, it became the mission of a branch of the USDA called the National Organic Program to ensure the integrity and transparency of the organic label. And that was the whole point of creating a national label, was that so there'd be one set of standards for the country, and that it, and your money and my money are spent on intact through taxes on building the infrastructure to guarantee that through inspections and so forth. And, you know, 9/10 of what the National Organic Program does is good. But the 10th it isn't, and it's probably more like a 20th is bad, and that 20th accounts for a great deal of sales. And that's, you know, that's why we have a fairly tragic situation. So, yes, there is an opportunity for a store like a co-op to say, we understand that you're very busy. And my sister said the same thing to me. I asked her, did you read my last letter? And she, big silence. And I said, you didn't read my letter? She said, Davey, I'm busy. I'm really busy. I'm doing all this stuff. She's a guardian ad litem. She does great work. And she said, I just trust you. You tell me what to do. And, you know, I got it, right? I would trust her if I had a problem with a kid in the court system. I'd call her up and say, tell me what to do to help this kid, because she knows that system. So people are looking to people like you and me to give them guidance. And I think that this is something that responsible stores that care about this can do. They can educate people and say, maybe I'm not asking a co-op to say we won't carry Driscoll's. I'm asking them to say, do you know that Driscoll's, much of Driscoll's is hydroponic? And just help the customer be informed, and they can make the decision. Do you know that Smart Chicken comes from a CAFO? Fine if you want to carry it. It is certified organic. It does come from a CAFO, right? And those chickens have never been outside in their lives. And then they, you know, they decide. I will say, I hope that the stores will try to offer a choice. I go to my local co-op, which I love, but the only chicken there is from Smart Chicken. It's not anything I want to buy. And the same is true for the blueberries. And they're going to have to work really hard to find alternatives. I know that. But that's what we have to do if we want to build a food system. If the co-ops do it, then after a while, you know, people are going to be talking to their local independent chain and say, well, why can't you get some of this? And then they will. And then the bigger chains go, oh, dear, I think we might have to start carrying some of this stuff. We're losing customers. So we can change the food system. It only works with our permission. If we withdraw
I'm not going to buy Driscoll's berries. I don't care if they're the only thing there until we get some you know, something else in season or not, or I'll go to, you know, I'll leave and go to the local, you know, farmer's market or something like that. I'm not going to buy those. I'm not going to buy, I mean, it's like, you know, the old picket lines. I'm not going to buy anything from them. And I'm not going to buy these other hydroponic wand vegetables. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a, and I think we do, you know, have that choice. And, you know, those of us who are lucky to, you know, get any berries at all, you know. And the other thing I think about is, you know, it used to be that people would go out and pick their own berries. And there'd be all these berry bushes, and you'd have these containers, and you'd, you know, you'd get your, you know, after having gone through that experience where you're picking your own berries and realizing that berries come from, you know, bushes. You know, they don't come from plastic, miles of plastic where they are so proud that, you know, we use less water. Yeah, why? Because you're running that same water through every little one of these overblown but wan plants, you know. So, you know, it's our choice to pick our own berries, to pick the berries we want, to pick the food we want, and, you know, and not and take a stand for that, you know. I just, you know, I hope people will. Anyway, it's been great talking with you, Dave Chapman of Real Organic Project, and we're coming to the end of our show time, and, you know, great conversation, and thank you, and to everyone at Real Organic, and to the farmers for, you know, this yeoman's work, and, you know, I think it's great that it's only a slice rather than all organic food, because that actually makes it more doable to become more conscious and push back on some of these terrible changes to our system. You know, it's not like we have to permanently fast until the real food comes back.
No. Keep eating. Buy organic. I always do. But keep insisting that we move that to real organic. That's right.
That's it. Thank you.
All right, Allison.
And thank
you,
listeners.
Very much. It's always a pleasure.
Sure. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We will be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, stand tall, keep marching forward with all our relations.